Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather around the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people involved, and its host and founder and shining light is Carol Marks. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. And we'll be joined on this program by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, who's going to talk about charity scams. That's coming up later in the program. Let's kick it off right now with a conversation conducted by Carol Marks with Dr. Mel Pohl. Dr. Mel Pohl is a board-certified family physician who specializes in treating chronic pain and co-occurring addiction. He's also the medical director of the Las Vegas Recovery Center. He's going to talk to Carol about his new book titled The Pain Antidote, the proven program to help you stop suffering from chronic pain, avoid addiction to painkillers, and reclaim your life. It's published by DeCapo Lifelong Books.
When did you first get interested in chronic pain and the potential for addiction to the pain medications that are prescribed for it? And have you experienced pain yourself?
Right. Well, I'm an addiction specialist. I'm a family doc and had a general family practice for a number of years, but also ran addiction programs. And the more time that went by, more people were becoming addicted to these opioid painkillers, and I would take them off through a medical, challenging medical regimen, and at the end of their detoxification, they would say, well, what are you going to do about my pain? Because more than 50% of people who were abusing these opioids had pain. And I would say, I don't know. I'm not here to treat your pain. I'm here to treat your addiction. And it got to be, it just became time for me to investigate what realistically and practically I could do to offer people some relief from their chronic pain. In the meantime, I had hurt my back around the same time, probably a few years before, and was suffering on and off with some pretty serious discomfort of my own. So it was sort of a two-edged way to get towards some answers.
What is chronic pain, and how does it differ from acute pain?
Acute pain is the purpose. It's what pain is really for. Acute pain is related to an injury or tissue damage or potential tissue damage, and it's the body's response to threat. So if you sprain your ankle, for example, and it hurts, you don't walk on it because the signal of the acute pain says there's injury, baby it, let it heal. And acute pain happily, thankfully, ends when its purpose is diminished. On the other hand, chronic pain really is a totally different phenomenon. The only thing that acute and chronic pain have in common is that word pain. Chronic pain is established not only in the body but also in the brain. And there is a circuitry inside the human brain that interprets signals from, let's say, I mean, I have back pain. So my back, there's a bulging disc. It presses on a nerve. The nerve fires regularly, you know, hundreds of times an hour. And that signal registers inside the areas of my brain that perceive pain, and it's relentless. And because of that relentlessness, my brain interprets this as something that's very significant and needs attention. So it triggers anxiety, and it triggers fear, and it triggers, for me, anger, frustration, and eventually depression. Well, the truth of the matter is this bulging disc causing me pain is unnecessary. It's maladaptive. It doesn't serve the function that acute pain serves. I don't need my back pain. I can stand on my head. I just hiked in New Zealand. I can ride a bicycle. I can lift weights. I can do everything that I'm physically capable of doing. The pain is just an annoyance and a source of frustration. And that chronic pain phenomenon related to that emotional stress is really the essence of chronic pain.
These emotions then affect the activity in our brains and nerve cells, right?
They do. They do, and they aggravate the pain. I mean, anybody who has pain that's outlasted its usefulness, let's say 3 to 6 months long, knows how frustrating it can be and how depressing it can be and how it interferes with sleep. So the essence of the experience of chronic pain is in the emotional centers of our brain.
Now, can you explain what's the difference between being dependent and addicted to a medication?
Very good question. Very complicated answer. But basically, addiction is a disease that lives in the part of the brain where really the neighborhood of brain function where pain is experienced. So people take medication for pain, and inadvertently they cross a line where they're now, and here's the definition of addiction, pathologically pursuing the relief that they're getting from these pills. And it's the pathological nature that really defines the disease. I see a lot of people in my practice who have started out taking pills for pain relief and ended up with an escalating dose, tolerance, inability to stop, and they're going to two doctors and three doctors, or occasionally they'll take more than their prescribed dose and they'll run out early. There's a number of symptoms related to the pathology, if you will, the really abnormal continuing to do this despite the fact that my life is getting worse phenomenon related to addiction that happens in a percentage of people who are taking painkillers on a sort of legitimate basis. They started out with the best intentions. They're not going to the street and shooting heroin. They're not smoking marijuana to get high. They're simply trying to be out of pain. Dependence is a phenomenon that occurs related to the drug's effect on an individual, and certain individuals are more likely to become dependent than others. The dependence really means I can't stop because my body needs it. And there is a medical process that we do it in Las Vegas at the Recovery Center and around the country to medically separate a person from that drug. If it's merely dependence and not addiction, once the drug is gone, the person goes on with his or her life more successfully.
Very well stated. Now, the Las Vegas Recovery Center that you head up uses a lot of evidence-based or alternative treatments to help patients alleviate their chronic pain. How can the correct breathing help, and what about exercise, meditation, and acupressure? Are those all helpful things to do?
Yes. The standard fare, which we might call pain management, is medication and increasing doses of medication and adding another medication on top of a medication and then adding another medication for the side effects of the first medication, or sticking a needle in somebody's spine, or in the extreme example, operating, infusing the spine. We in Las Vegas have a totally different philosophy. We think that until and unless you deal with the emotional aspects of pain, the area of the brain that's stimulating this pain experience, the best surgeon, best neurosurgeon in the country is not going to really cause somebody to have a better life. And really, pain treatment needs to be about having a better life. That's what the pain antidote is really all about. So how do you get a better life? You reduce your anxiety, anger, fear, depression, deal with the stress, increase exercise. I mean, really, one of the things that I see with people who have illnesses like chronic headaches or fibromyalgia or back pain, such as mine, is that they don't move. They don't function in their life. Their life shrinks, and the real restoration of function is what pain recovery is all about, and that's what we talk about in the book. So it's really about things that are going to reduce pain, and acupressure and acupuncture are very effective means for many people. Stretching and exercise, absolutely crucial, increasing blood flow, mobility and activity level, and then all those mood changers that you mentioned. And I think one of the most important is mindfulness or meditative practice, where you really just learn to allow the experience to be present without judging it, without trying to change it, and it really just morphs into, you know, this is just part of my life, and what's important to me, and what am I going to commit to so that I can have a better life.
You know, excellent common sense things that we can do. Now, you have a really interesting chapter in your book on how what we eat can affect our chronic pain level, that certain foods can aggravate chronic pain while others can alleviate it. So what are some of the foods that reduce pain? And I didn't realize nutrition could be helpful when it comes to pain.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you think about it logically, what we put into the engine is really going to affect the way the joints function and the way the cardiovascular the system functions and the overall experience of pain. So we go through in a lot of detail. My co-author, Kathy Ketchum, researched this chapter brilliantly. And it's really some very basic things around nutrition and around healthy eating and around not excessively ingesting things that are bad for the system, you know, that might clog it up. And, you know, the most obvious ones are sugar and alcohol, and even though it's not food, nicotine and tobacco-related toxins. And then it's really about finding things that are pain-reducing, and there's a variety, I mean, there's long lists of things, sour cherries and a variety of different spices like turmeric and other fresh fruit products. And then again, a really balance of protein, fat, and carbohydrates, but much more natural carbohydrates. Cold water fish, for example, is a great source of protein. Certain teas that are not pain-provoking but pain-reducing.
That's Dr. Mel Pohl in conversation with Carol Marks. His book is titled The Pain Antidote, the proven program to help you stop suffering from chronic pain, avoid addiction to painkillers, and reclaim your life, published by DeCapo Lifelong Books. And if you like more information, go to the website thepainantidotebook.com. That's thepainantidotebook.com. Carol Marks returns in just a moment when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. The National Institute of Mental Health reports elderly depression to be a serious public health problem. Recent research shows 15% of persons over 60, or roughly 6.5 million Americans, are suffering from depression, while 25% state they suffer from sadness. Health practitioners that care and treat the elderly, including primary care physicians, are unprepared to detect and diagnose depression. Let's review depression's warning signs. Are you experiencing feelings of helplessness or sadness, most of the time lasting 2 weeks or longer? Have family members, friends noticed social withdrawal, self-neglect with personal hygiene, appearance, clothing, loss of appetite, weight loss, and maybe dehydration? Has your physical pain increased? Has there been a major loss, illness, or surgery recently? If any of these scenarios exist, an evaluation by a qualified MD is recommended. Successful treatment of depression would include both psychotherapy and medications. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we turn again to Carol Marks in conversation now with Dr. Stephen Lamb. He's a practicing internist and a faculty member at New York University School of Medicine and the director of the NYU Preston Robert Tisch Center for Men's Health. He's going to talk to Carol about his new book titled Fighting Fat, Get Healthy for Life, published by Spry Publishing.
Now, for nearly a century, we've been hearing from physicians, all we need to do is lose weight, eat less, and exercise more. So why doesn't that work?
Yeah, and I think that's the problem. It intuitively makes sense, eat less and exercise more, but it doesn't work. And I'll explain to you. Number one, you will lose for short periods of time, but the body has really been, you know, engineered to defend against weight loss. And so in the process, when you start to eat less, you start losing some fat cells, and all of a sudden there are signals that are being released by your body to your brain, which is encouraging you to lower your metabolic rate as well as to increase your hunger. And so ultimately, you know, you succumb to these desires because you just can't sustain it. The body's regulatory mechanisms are extremely tight. And just as though I could convince you not to wear a coat in the winter, I can't convince your brain that you're not cold. And so ultimately you give in. And the same thing really happens for, you know, invariably most people with obesity. They can successfully lose weight, but they just can't sustain it. And for those people who can, I really applaud them, because it's almost impossible. And it explains why, you know, some highly motivated, intelligent, resourceful people have managed to gain and lose 50 pounds in their lifetime multiple times. It's not because they're stupid and lazy. It's because they can't overcome the biologic signals. And we're now starting to understand what those signals are.
Now, you know, it's those darn hormones that act up when we lose large amounts of weight. So
Correct. What
would happen, because you write in your book that it's better to lose small amounts of weight?
Well, here's the problem. I think that what we're saying in the book is that even a 5 or 10% weight reduction can have a very significant impact on your health. And, you know, your body will probably not fight you at that 5 or 10% mark. And so if you go from 200 to 180, you know, the likelihood of you needing some diabetes medicines or blood pressure have dramatically reduced. If you're trying to go from 200 to 150, you're going to be struggling, because it's a very difficult task to deal with that amount of weight loss over a period of time, because your body is going to reject that attempt because it's trying to defend against starvation. So what I'm really saying in the book is, one, obesity is a disease. Obesity is a complex biology. It's not the result of a lack of willpower or determination. It's a complicated signaling system. Go to your doctor. Make certain you don't have diabetes and heart disease and cholesterol as a result of your obesity. Create a strategy that will work. Maybe reduce certain medicines that may be making you fat. Try to be helped with reference to sleeping and working and stress. Appreciate that, yes, there are certain dietary suggestions, like maybe decreasing carbs. Consider some medications. And if you're morbidly obese, consider surgery. So what we're saying is that we have a strategy. It's not eating according to your astrologic sign or finding some crazy diet, because they're absolutely not going to work in the long term. Short term, of course, they'll work. But we're looking at the long-term consequences, not the short-term consequences.
Now, if you got your weight down that 5 or 10%, say it got down to 180, as you've said, then after a period of time, should you try to go another 5, 10%?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can continue to follow a program, but the program then will require you to maintain your exercise, increase the intensity of the exercise. You know, for weight loss, you need 30 to 40 minutes of exercise 5 days a week. Now, that's a very difficult commitment. And most people, you know, say, well, I walk a little bit. That's just not enough for people with obesity. I mean, you really have to exercise. And unfortunately, when you're really overweight and you have a lot of fat, it's very hard for you to exercise. So you have to develop a strategy, maybe with a trainer, so that you can increase the intensity of your exercise as you increase your fitness level. But I do think there's a lot that people can do. They have to eat well. They have to reduce the carbs in their diet. They have to avoid the snacking. They have to avoid skipping meals. They have to try to eat earlier in the day. Yes, all these things will make a difference. But you also have to understand that there's a biologic barrier that you're going to have to overcome, and that's why you need to go to the doctor.
And as the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute said in their new guidelines, that physicians should take the lead in diagnosing weight problems.
Exactly.
But the patient
needs
to know something, too. Don't they know to bring it up?
Well, here's the problem. You know, the doctors and, you know, have the same bias that the general population do, that it's a disease of willpower and character. And, you know, they're also embarrassed to bring it up, you know, and they may have brought it up in the past, and they've been rejected in their, you know, inquiry. And they also have failed to keep up with the new science and the new biology and the new treatments that are available.
And the doctors today are going to be challenged again to try to, you know, basically re-educate themselves. Because a lot of this stuff really came up around the year 2000. And if you've been in medical school, you know, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, you're not aware of this new science. So the physicians need to be educated. And believe me, there are plenty of courses for them now, but I don't think it would be terribly insulting to a doctor if you brought him a copy of the book. You know, the two chapters have been written by psychopharmacologists at NYU, the bariatric surgeons, myself. It's not an insult to a doctor, you know, for a patient to bring it to the doctor.
Now, when it comes to losing weight, you've emphasized over and over in your book that every person needs an individualized approach. One size doesn't fit all, so why is that so important?
Well, Carol, that's a great, great point, and I think the point I'm trying to make is that there's some people, for example, who are shift workers, okay? They don't have traditional work hours. There's another group that basically travels a few times a week. Then there's another person who's having a lot of stress and chaos in their lives because of socioeconomic reasons. You know, you have a single mother, several children, two jobs. You have to individualize your treatment. You can't tell this lady she's got to exercise five. When is she going to have the time to do this? There are some people who are going to be on some medications that you need to alter or change in order to facilitate weight loss. There are some people who already have advanced heart disease. The treatments have to be individualized. Because of what I just said, there's so many factors that contribute to any one person's ability to either lose weight or not.
Now, what do you hope your readers will take away from your book?
Is that obesity is a serious disease. It is not because you have some sort of character flaw, that there may be individual reasons that you can make changes along with your physician to achieve at least a 5 or 10% weight loss, and you keep progressing that way. Don't give up. Don't try to fall into some magic formula diet. It's not going to happen. And hopefully, you know, you can work with your doctor, which is really what I'm trying to do, reclaim this for the medical profession to guide patients, because it's clearly the number one driver of disease in America.
That's Dr. Stephen Lamb in conversation with Carol Marks, and his book is titled Fighting Fat, Get Healthy for Life. It's published by Spry Publishing. We're going to be joined in a moment by Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine, and then in the next half hour, Steve Wiseman will join us, and he'll be talking about charity scams. That's next when A Touch of Grey continues. Michael Harrison here with you on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. Very proud to be with you on this program. This program has been on the air in one form or another consistently now for over two decades. Kind of runs below the radar. It's heard on weekends on great talk radio stations around the country. And what I'm really proud about in terms of this program, in which I have the opportunity to serve as anchor, not as host. Carol Marks is the host, and I certainly am not the only voice on this show. We have a round table of outstanding personalities, experts, and broadcasters. What I love about this show is that in an industry marked by concern, focus, obsession with youth, and believe me, I'm about as young thinking as anybody you'll meet. Sometimes I'm even accused of being immature. And so I'm all for that, and I'm all for looking ahead. But I'm also for fairness, and I'm also for respect. And the media in America, driven by, obviously, Madison Avenue and commercial concerns, focuses primarily on young people. And if somebody's over 50 or 55 or 60, they quite often find that there's a lot lacking in terms of what's available in the mainstream media. So this program, which was conceived and developed by Carol Marks more than 20 years ago, originally was called Senior Focus, and it evolved into A Touch of Grey, and I became involved with it along the way, is something that really provides a service in as much as it unashamedly, unabashedly, unapologetically brings information to people via this wonderful medium of radio that is of use, of interest, of service, of comfort, of support to people over 50 years of age and their families, which is why I say at the beginning of the program, children of all ages, because so many people in their 50s find themselves in a situation that has been kind of accurately and colorfully termed the sandwich generation. meaning they have children, adult children, still living with them, and abiding by the rule that came down a long time ago, honor thy father and thy mother, they have their parents living with them. In many cases, these parents are in their 80s, 90s, and are living at home. And the amount of pressure that can be put on somebody dealing with adult children and senior parents all under one roof is extraordinary, and it's a phenomenon that in many ways I applaud. I'm all for families staying together. But also, there are people who are in need of support and information. So in many ways, A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, is in fact a program for children of all ages. But I salute Carol Marx. I think that she has done and continues to do a remarkable job. And she does it under sometimes the worst of conditions because, like the rest of us, she's not getting any younger either. But she drives herself to research and get the information needed and select guests and topics. And not only that, she travels around the world and brings information from other countries on how their healthcare systems operate and how the services that they provide for senior citizens there are taken care of and done. And she brings that information back, not to mention she acts as a model, as a role model for people to get up and get out and live life and do things. And she's done everything from, she's explored, you know, if there were four corners on this planet, as the saying goes, she's been to all four of them. Check her out at the website, atouchofgray.com. Gray is spelled with an E. And I just wanted to mention that she is one fine lady, and we're grateful to be involved with her in this project.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. It is important to address a personal emergency response system in your home in case of falls or injuries. AARP encourages their use for many older Americans to enhance independence and security, especially for those living alone. Many brands of PERS are available on the market, and seniors should consider their specific needs and budget before deciding on a system. The Federal Trade Commission provides free online information. One can get a system as basic as wearing a necklace or bracelet and push a button that will transmit to an installed response center through your landline telephone. In the event of an emergency with falls, chest pain, a suspected intruder, a press of the button will have a 911 ambulance dispatched to your home, even if you cannot reach your phone. PERS systems can be rented or purchased through local hospitals and are affordable and serviced by representatives. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're at that point in the program, as we are each week at this time, when we're joined by Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. He's the vice president and executive editor of the trade publication that serves talk radio. And we talk about things going on the air that might be of interest or relate in some way to the upper demographic nature of this program. And last week, Kevin, we were talking about the election and how the presidential election of 2016 is, of course, very interesting because every day there seems to be new candidates. And we were talking about Bernie Sanders, and we didn't mention the fact that he's 73 years old. And even though he plays the role of the guy that's kind of off on the extreme, he seems to have tremendous respect from everybody. He just seems to have respect for being a man of integrity. And you don't hear, I guess perhaps if he becomes a more serious candidate, you will, but you don't hear at this point people saying he's too old to be president. That doesn't seem to be an issue. He seems to have that elder statesman ambience about him. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right about that. You know, it's interesting. There, if you remember going back to, 1980?
Yeah.
And the accusations that Reagan was very old, and he was approximately the same age, wasn't he? 72, 73, something like that?
I believe he was in his early 70s.
Yeah, very, very early 70s. And back then, I must admit that he seemed older than. I don't think 73 is that old now, especially for someone who has the experience that a guy like Sanders has. I think people look to that as maybe the badge of honor that perhaps they should, is it shows experience.
Well, you know, it's a striking juxtaposition to people like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, who are noticeably youthful looking for people running for president.
And yeah.
I don't know if that's because I'm getting older. I remember when I was a kid growing up, and kind of before your time, I was in my early teens when John F. Kennedy was running for president, and I was always amazed, people saying, he's so young, and he was the same age as my father. He was
right.
In his mid-40s, and he looked like a grown man to me. I mean, I couldn't understand, why are they saying he's so young? And have you ever looked back at some films of Kennedy now talking as president? He was like a kid. He was like a kid.
He sure did. Uh-huh. Look, Barack Obama looked like a kid 8 years ago. Now, clearly, six years ago, whatever it was, he had less gray hair then, but Obama is still a very young-looking man.
Yeah, he is a young-looking man. I got to tell you, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz look like kids to me. Am I revealing my age? They just look like kids, and I don't hold that against them. And again, I have that experience of Kennedy, seeing Kennedy from the perspective of a teenager, and now seeing him from the perspective of a man in my 60s. And, it's just amazing what your point of view happens to be. Now, let's talk about Joe Biden. Joe Biden is the vice president of the United States. You don't hear him in the conversation about being a candidate,
right.
Although he has every qualification to run for president. You may like him, you may not like him, but he certainly has the qualifications and the stripes to be in the game.
Sure, he's been VP for 8 years, or right. Will have been VP for 8 years. That certainly qualifies him.
Absolutely, and a long history in the Senate, et cetera. He's 72 years old.
Mm.
And Biden, I mean, I know he had the hair weaving and all that. And, of course, thinking back to what you said before about Ronald Reagan, he had dark hair, and it never really has been revealed whether that was natural or Hollywood. But Biden seems very youthful. We only have about a minute. Doesn't he?
He does. I would say he's got a certain youthful vitality about him. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't necessarily have Kennedy. You know, he's not a young-looking 72, but he's got the vitality, as I said. He seems like a guy who's not going to, conk out any minute now. So it's funny, and I think it goes back to what sounds strange because it doesn't make sense, but really, 73, 72, it doesn't seem as old as it did 30 years ago, 35, when Reagan was running.
And it's not based upon modern health procedures,
right.
How people take care of themselves, and how people feel about age. And I guess that's a good thing. Certainly you don't want somebody in the presidency who has any ounce, but a molecule of immaturity about them. You sure don't want that. It's too important. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. Folks, that's Kevin Casey. He's the vice president and executive editor of the trade magazine Talkers. Want to know what's going on behind the scenes in talk radio? Check it out at talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison. Steve Wiseman joins us next when A Touch of Gray continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. New guidelines from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism for persons 65 and older reveal that if women drink more than 7 drinks per week or greater than 3 drinks per occasion, and men 14 drinks per week or greater than 4 drinks per occasion, you're at risk for illness or injury. As the body ages, the tolerance to alcoholic beverages decreases. Literally, at 65 and older, you're unable to process excess, alcoholic beverages, as say a person that is 45. Alcoholic overuse and intolerance can worsen mental confusion, problems with balance and falls, depressive disorders, dehydration, inadequate nutrition, adverse interaction with some medications, and can lead to social isolation. One drink is 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of liquor, or the amount in a shot glass. Are you ready to acknowledge that at age 65 and older, that fewer than 7 drinks per week or one drink per day is the limit and offers you the advantages of leading a healthier and safer lifestyle? I'm Suzanne Hannes. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
When we ran out, we stopped using it.
Why would you stop?
Why undo all the good that's been accomplished? We thought everything was fine, and that was not a good thing.
No.
He started stinking. It was awful.
Shedding comes back, loss of hair, lots of dandruff.
Scratching will return. His shedding will increase.
If I ever took Roy off of Dinovite, he would go back to his hair loss.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dinovite,
when I get to about 3/4,
oh no, I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order.
Dinovite.com.
Each and every day she is getting that Dinovite.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dinovite. If it's working, don't quit.
Don't do what I did and run out.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We're joined the rest of the way by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. And now he's in conversation with Dr. Amit Sood. He's the chair of the Mind-Body Medicine Initiative at Mayo Clinic, and he's going to talk to Steve about the Mayo Clinic Handbook for Happiness, a 4-step plan for resilient living published by DeCampo Lifelong Books.
Certain books are written for some people, but who doesn't want to be happy? I mean, this book is for everybody, isn't it?
I would like to think so, and we have worked with hundreds of thousands of people and tapped into wisdom of thousands and thousands of scientists and spiritual luminaries and philosophers to come up with this whole theme of how we can have authentic, sustained, deep happiness in 2015.
You know, that's one of the things that I enjoyed about the book, and it's very, very user-friendly, is that it really crosses a lot of disciplines. But I'm curious, you as a medical doctor, what prompted you to write the book?
Well, I'll give you a Twitter version of my life story. So I came to to U.S. in 1995 after having studied medicine for 10 years in India. And in my first year of medical school, our town had a chemical spill that killed about 10,000 people in one night.
Oh,
so
my
pal. First 10 years, I saw a lot of stress and suffering. And I equated stress and suffering with malnutrition and infections and so on. So that by the time I was coming to U.S., I thought I was going to come to Disneyland of the world. I thought here you grow up as a child in Disneyland, you play slots in Las Vegas when you are an adult, and you retire playing bingo in Florida. And I was seeing too many movies. So when I came to New York and I saw a lot of stress and suffering, more than all what I thought there would be, that surprised and shocked me, which prompted me to study human brain and mind and who we are as a species. And I realized that our brain by design is designed to create unhappiness. Our brain was designed mm-hmm. for survival and safety. It was not designed for peace and happiness. There are many neural predispositions that predispose to happiness, unhappiness, even in people who have otherwise perfect life.
Sure.
That led me to say, I need to share this information broadly, and that's how I started doing this.
How do we control our own happiness?
Well, happiness is a choice. You can manufacture happiness by putting the right ingredients in life that create happiness. So understanding happiness isn't seeking selfish, sensory pleasures or material goods. Happiness is deep, sustained fulfillment that you get from living a good, virtuous, and meaningful life. How do you do that? We have a 4-step plan. And the first step is, step zero actually is to understand why we are unhappy by knowing a little bit about brain and stress and resilience and mind and how we operate. Step one is to enhance our attention by bringing better presence in the world, by bringing focused, relaxed, and kind presence. For example, when you're reading book to a child, try not to get caught skipping pages while reading a book to your child. And be there. When you're talking to your spouse, do not blank out if you can. Do not consider your spouse's words as clicking sounds. You know, pay full attention. When you're getting home at 6 o'clock in the evening, for first 3 minutes, do not improve anybody. Meet them as long-lost friends. So our practices are very real-world, sprinkled in daily life. So that is the first aspect, attention. Then
yes.
There are some time-tested principles that when you integrate in your life, they enhance happiness. That is the second step. And the five principles are gratitude, compassion, acceptance, higher meaning in life, and forgiveness. When you bring these together, they enhance happiness, well-being, lower stress, lower anxiety. And then once you're ready, step three is to develop a mind-body practice for deeper immersion. That is an optional step. The first two are really the most crucial steps. Step four is to make one good change in your life. So our skills, the whole program takes less than 5 minutes, Steve, to practice. You can look at a YouTube video, 5-3-2 plan, which is a very short 1 minute video that sort of synthesizes all this together. The skills we see are not adding more milk to your glass of milk. It is adding chocolate powder to your milk so that the whole life tastes better.
Does being happy actually help your health?
No doubt in my mind. Actually, when you add life to your ears, you add ears to your life. That is what research shows. Mm-hmm. Happiness increases your longevity. When your face is smiling, actually your body cells are smiling, your genes are smiling, your heart is smiling, your nervous system is smiling. And happiness is very infectious. So when you're happy, that makes your friend happy, your friend's friend happy, and your friend's friend happy. That is what research is showing. So happiness equals wellness. When you start giggling, your body starts moving. One of the best things you can do to help others be happier is to be happy yourself. Happiness, health, creativity, relationships, longevity, no matter how you parse it, happiness will take you to a better place.
What are some of the habits that we should try and cultivate to help us be happy?
So some of the basic core habits are anything that is going to make you healthier is likely to make you happier. That is the first step. So first set of habits. So healthy diet, exercise, good sleep, self-care, all of that. Then beyond that, having enough and being content with what you have,
mm-hmm.
being grateful for what you have, that makes you happier. There are three core elements after that. The first one is connecting. So connecting with people in a deep, meaningful way and having deep, nurturing relationships. Second is creating, doing some creative pursuit, reading a book, garden, sewing, playing with your pet, playing with your kids or grandkids. So creating, creative activities. And third is comforting, having compassion and kindness for others. Those are the three core aspects that can enhance your happiness.
Right, what are some of the biggest impediments that we face? People always seem to be in a rush. You talk about, you know, appreciating and living in the moment and gratitude, and it always seems like too many people are in a rush to do something else or get something more. And how do you get people to slow down?
I think we are too busy to be happy, and we are too intelligent to be happy. That is a problem. Our brain is designed with a negativity bias. Our brain is designed to inflate the bad and discount the good. That is how our brain is designed. So we come in the way of our own happiness. Granted, you know, sometimes life throws a curveball and we get stuck. Our goal is that when we end up on that rumble strip, we use some of these values to recover fast instead of letting ourselves go into the ditch. So when you do not take charge, when you do not bring intentionality, your brain is likely to take you into the unhappiness loop. But when you take charge and bring intentionality and overcome these neural predispositions, prioritize so that you're not that busy, delegate appropriately, connect with people who care about you. I have a small video, Love Yourself Like Your Pet Does, again on YouTube. So when you look
at
yourself
dangerous.
With the eyes of your pet, I think those are some aspects that can take away the impediments towards happiness. One thing is believe in those who believe in you. I choose not to believe in those who do not believe in me. And that's how I have better self-esteem each day.
Dr. Amit Sood in conversation with Stephen J.J. Wiseman, and the book is titled The Mayo Clinic Handbook for Happiness, a Four-Step Plan for Resilient Living, published by DeCapo Lifelong Books. Steve returns in just a moment.
Retrievers, Labradors, Goldens are the main breeds that come through our door, but we'll train anything with four legs and a tail. My husband and I train hunting dogs and also have a boarding and grooming business. And our dogs, they're athletes, and we feed them very quality food. You can't get enzymes in a commercial dog food because they cook it at such a high heat, but adding Dynavite to their diet has every single dog in my kennel looking better than they have ever looked.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Dynavite's the bomb.
Tell everybody we know about Dynavite. Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dynavite, it's time to place my order.
Dynavite.com.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000. DINOVITE.com.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. You may recognize the symptoms of elderly depression, loss of appetite, weight loss, social withdrawal, problems with hygiene, neglecting personal well-being, or even a sadness that lasts over 2 weeks. Sound familiar? Here's what you can do about it. Exercise, eat well, and don't forget to socialize. Researchers at Duke University suggest exercising at least 3 times a week to keep the body and mind healthy. That means swimming, walking, and maybe light exercise classes with the approval of your medical doctor. Another key to happiness is maintaining self-esteem through clubs and groups. You might consider the gardening club or a musical choir. And lastly, treat your body well, and it will thank you by feeling well. That means practicing good nutrition and eating well-balanced meals daily. Naturally, the needs of patients vary, but feel free to consult a geriatric specialist to make a personalized treatment plan. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Whoa, a digital music player. Thanks, Mom.
Glad you like it. We can finally toss out that old massive stereo.
Mom, you can't just throw out electronics. They need to be recycled or donated.
Recycled? Like aluminum cans?
Yeah. You just go to greenergadgets.org, enter your zip code, and it tells you where the nearest certified recycling center is.
I knew that.
Okay, Mom.
Recycling electronics is as easy as buying them. Log on to greenergadgets.org to find electronics recycling options near you.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of this hour of our broadcast, and we're joined again by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. Steve Wiseman is an attorney. He's an author. He's an expert on so many of the things we discuss on this program, including scams. He's one of the nation's leading experts on cybersecurity, fraud, and scams here in the digital age. He's written the book, The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. Also published by Prentice Hall is his latest book, Identity Theft Alert. And he has this amazing website that you can visit. It's scamicide.com, scamicide.com. Well, Steve is now going to talk about charity scams. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, in the years that I've been on A Touch of Gray, there's been no shortage of disasters, both natural and man-made, that have touched the hearts of people around the world seeking to help. And mankind, indeed, can be quite kind and giving when our fellow man is in need. And the generosity of people here in the United States and around the world is a wonderful thing. However, you knew there was a but coming, right? Scammers are always present at times like this, eager to take our charitable impulse and turn it into an opportunity to steal money that you want to help people to line their own pocketbooks. The recent earthquake in Nepal, which has killed more than 3,000 people and affected many more, is one of those events that's drawn many people who want to help by making a donation to a charity that can provide assistance to the affected people of Nepal. However, there are many scammers who are setting up phony charities or using the names of legitimate charities to steal charitable donations. And this is something you really need to be careful about. Be very wary of telemarketers seeking charitable contributions. Whenever you receive a telephone call that purports to be from a charity, you can't be sure that that caller is legitimate. In addition, even if the caller is a legitimate solicitor on behalf of a charity, they work on commission, and some of what you donate will be going to the telemarketer. If a telemarketer arouses your interest in a particular charity, ask the telemarketer to send you written information that you can review before making a contribution directly to the charity, and that way you know it'll go entirely to the charity. As for email and text message solicitations from charities, be particularly careful, because not only can you not be sure if they're legitimate or not, they may be worse than that. The email or text message may contain a link or attachment that has malware that can steal the information from your computer or smartphone and use it to make you a victim of identity theft. CharityNavigator.org, that's CharityNavigator.org, is a great resource. It's a free website at which you can look up any charity to which you may be considering making a donation. Not only will CharityNavigator.org tell you whether or not the charity is a scam or not, it'll also tell you how much of the money given to the charity goes towards the charitable works and how much it pays in salary and administrative costs. Some of the well-established and highly rated charities presently working on the Nepal relief effort include America Cares, CARE, Catholic Relief Services, Direct Relief, Global Giving, Save the Children, and the SIVA Foundation. You can get a lot more information about these charities and others at CharityNavigator.org, as well as find links to the charities themselves where you can make a donation.
Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Charity scams, be on the lookout, and check out scamaside.com. And Identity Theft Alert is Steve's latest book, published by Prentice Hall. Steve Wiseman, one of our senior correspondents here on A Touch of Gray. Thank you, Kevin Casey, also a senior correspondent, for joining us. Thank you, Beverly Santanella, our producer on the front line organizing it. And most importantly, a big thanks to Carol Marks for the fine job she has done over the years as the host and founder of this program. On behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison in the Anchor Chair, inviting you to join us here next weekend for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.